they're in the room, and he says, let's get the gun out, let's, you know, let's have some fun with this gun. And she gets the gun out, and she takes the clip out, assuming it's empty, points it straight at his chest, so it's touching his chest, and then pulls the trigger, not realizing that there's one in the chamber. As far as she can see, the gun is empty. And there's this moment where they both know that they can't turn it back. And Edwin says, you shot me. And she says, sorry, dude. And then Edwin's eyes go into the back of his head, and Edwin dies.
That's Gary Young, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Gary Young on Gun Down, Kids Getting Killed. After the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre in 2012, impending firearm control legislation led to panic buying of guns throughout the country. In 2016, the prospect of Hillary as president led to another rush to buy. Smith & Wesson stock prices soared. Remington Arms Company boosted production. Walmart gun sales went way up. Incidents of gun violence only seem to induce more gun buying. Gun owners complain of bullet shortages. The gun homicide rate is at least 6 times higher in the United States than in any country in the world, and all too often, it is young people getting killed. With Trump in the White House, the prospects for any meaningful gun control legislation are nil, and the blood in the streets, malls, and schools will continue to flow. Our guest today is Gary Young. He's an award-winning columnist for The Guardian and the author of The Speech and Another Day in the Death of America. He writes the Beneath the Radar column for The Nation. He spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. And now, Gary Young.
Every day in America, on average, 7 children or teens are shot dead. And so I decided to pick a day at random and then find out who these kids are. I spent 18 months finding where I could families and kin, preachers and teachers and friends and baseball coaches, anybody that I could find who knew anything about them, I would find and interview them. I also spent an awful long time combing through their Facebook pages, their Twitter feeds, their Instagrams. The idea was to put a human face, a child's face, on what I call the collateral damage of gun control. And oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, these deaths tell you something bigger than just the particular incident in which they died. They fell, as you'll hear, across America in barrios in Texas and in ghettos in different urban areas, in rural areas, at a sleepover, on a stairwell, on a street corner. This was not a representative day, it was a random day. You pick a different day, you get different kids, and you get different stories. On an average day, of the 7 kids who would die, 2 would be female. On this day, none are female. On an average day, 3 of the kids would be black, 3 would be white, and 1 would be Latino. And every third day, an Asian American, Pacific Islander, or Native American would be rotated into that mix. The one thing I'm pretty sure of is that I didn't get all of the kids who died that day, because, or shot dead that day, because suicides aren't reported. And 2 of the 7 on average would be suicides. So I'm pretty sure I didn't get all of the kids that got shot dead that day. And the way that I got them, the way that I got the fact of them was through a couple of websites that record, that were at the time, this is post Newtown, and so there were a couple of websites that were doing gun tallies each day. So through them and through other reports, neither of them got all of these 10. And through other reports, that's how I found them. And then the reporting involved reaching out in a range of ways, going to the funeral parlors that buried them, the preachers that gave that did the services, reaching out on Facebook and Twitter, and in a couple of cases, literally walking the streets of certain areas, putting notes in letterboxes. Not all of these people are easy to reach, or their families aren't easy to reach. Of the 10, I did reach 8 where they were kin. There were 2 where I didn't, and as you'll hear, 1, the family didn't want to speak to me, and in 1, I just simply couldn't reach anybody. I flew out to San Jose, went to every address that I had. I messaged every Facebook contact I could find, an Instagram contact I could find, and it just didn't work. On the day that I chose, 10 kids got shot dead, 7 black, 2 Latino, 1 white. And so the first boy, Jaden Dixon. Jaden's 9 years old, and he's the youngest to be shot dead in this 24-hour period. He's actually shot on the Friday morning, November the 22nd, which is also the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. And so the papers are full on that day of America's lost innocence. And one of the things I've found when reporting here over the 12 years that I did was that America can be very careless with its innocence. It loses it, it finds it again, it loses it again. Jaden got up on this Friday morning, and his mum, Nicole, had a rule, and the rule was, if you're up and all the way ready, all the way, socks and shoes, then you can do what you want. Minecraft, he liked. Duck Dynasty, he was a big fan of, so he could watch some reruns of that. Cars. And so Jaden had done his task, and he was ready this morning. And so, as you know, the rest of the family bustled, there was a knock at the door, and Jaden jumped up from, I think he was playing Minecraft, to get the door. Now, the assumption was that it was 2 girls from down the street who would often come over in the morning, or occasionally come over in the morning, to borrow some sugar or some milk or maybe look for a ride to school. So there was nothing kind of that surprising. This is in Grove City, Ohio, which is a suburb of Columbus. It won Ohio's best hometown that year. And Grove City is the kind of place that people don't leave. It's delightfully boring, if you like. So his mum, Nicole, grew up there. One of her friends, her kids were the third generation to go to that high school. Most of her friends were people that she went to school with. Her kids were friends with people's, you know, with the children of friends that she went to school with. It's that kind of place. Even as she was describing to me how little crime, I asked, when's the last person to get shot here? And even as she was describing how safe it was, the police came over at 9:30 to say that their dog was barking and disturbing the neighbors. So that's the kind of thing police do in Grove City, Ohio. There's a knock at the door. Jaden runs to the door. He opens the door, and he's kind of hiding behind the door as though to jump out at these girls and shout, boo. But nobody comes in. And so he slowly just peers his head around the corner of the door, and bang, he's shot square in the head. The man with the gun is Danny Thornton, who is Nicole's ex-partner and the father of Jaden's eldest brother, Jared. And Danny doesn't deal with anger well. And Nicole had this on-off relationship with Danny. And he had been staying at the house maybe 9 months before. She was trying to, Jared was kind of running a bit wild. She wanted him to help out with Jared. He didn't have a job. So she said, well, why don't you stay here for a little bit? You work yourself out. You help with your son and you can contribute. But Danny couldn't keep a job. And so after a while, he wasn't contributing anything. But he had said to his son while he was there, I have no qualms making an orphan out of you. I'm not going to be a 47-year-old man sleeping in my car with no job. I'd rather die in what he called suicide by cop. And when Jared told Nicole this, she shook because she said he would do it. He would do it. And Jared said, you know, he's really blowing off steam. And when I spoke to one of Nicole's friends, she said, you know, we always used to talk about this because that's the kind of guy he was. But you just can't get to imagining that it would actually happen. And Nicole kicks Danny out after a while, asks him to leave because the boys want their room back. It gets to maybe a couple of weeks before. She's trying to save for Christmas and having a hard time. She works in a legal firm. And she texts him and says, I can't pay for your phone anymore. You're going to have to pay for it yourself. Danny wrote back a very short note saying, what took you so long? And when she passed that on to her friend, who had moved to Houston by that stage, her friend said, who's going to kill you? And they kind of talked about it, but they talked about it in a joking way. I mean, they thought he was a crazy person, and they thought he was a mad person. But she also thought, look, I'm the one who's been here for him in this last year, and so if he's going to shoot anybody, it's not going to be me. Anyway, it wasn't her, it was Jaden. Danny then sped off, leaving Jaden dying in the arms of Danny's son, Jared, and shot an ex-partner and the mother of one of his children, but did not kill her, shot her in the stomach, and then got his wish, and in a shootout with the police was shot dead later that day. Jaden, because they wanted to retrieve his organs for donation, did not die until midday, well, about 3 o'clock on the Saturday. Jaden was the youngest. The oldest was Kenneth Mills Tucker, and he died very early that morning in Indianapolis. It was like a scene from a David Lynch movie. There was this crackling of gunfire, and you hear the 911 calls, and it's just a range of people hearing this gunfire all around. Windows are pierced with bullets. There's one young couple with a baby begging 911 to get them out, to get them out of there. And then there's a car overturned in the street. Two people from the car sitting on the side of the road with aches and pains. One person who's disappeared but is later found. And then there's Kenneth, maybe about 100 feet from the car, lying, dying. And within 40 minutes at 3:57, he's declared, in the morning, he's declared dead. His last tweet, he said, I'm out with my boys, Wayne and Terrell, for my last weekend as a teenager. It was his last weekend, period. Kenneth's family were the only people who would not speak to me. I found his grandfather's phone number by matching names on the online obituary with names in the online white pages where there were large numbers of African Americans. American segregation makes a lot of this reporting quite easy, or at least logical. They gave me his father's number, and his granny was quite chatty. And when I spoke to his father, he said he'd get back to me, and he just never did. He never could. Clearly, I pursued him as much as you can without stalking somebody. And then when I went back to his grandparents, they said that they didn't want to talk to me either. I did, however, have Kenneth's Twitter feed and Facebook page. From that, I know that he knew several people who'd been shot dead. From his online obituary, I know that he worked at U-Haul and was a graduate. And there was quite a lot of braggadocio on his Twitter feed that occasionally mentioned guns, more often would mention weed, but occasionally would mention guns. Every now and then, he's 19, there was a kind of extensive, maybe 15 tweets thing where he breaks up with his girlfriend on Twitter and then gets back with her again. And only latterly, when I went to check the spelling of one of the people who was in the car, did it emerge that two of the people who were in the car were in a gang, a North Side Indianapolis gang, that there were warrants out for their arrest. So they were allegedly in a gang. I don't know if Kenneth was in a gang, although it seems likely from his tweets that he may have been. Nobody knows what that shooting was about, although it's assumed that it was gang-related and possibly drug-related. 5 months after, 5 months after Kenneth was shot, the NRA had their convention in Indianapolis, and I went along. And in terms of kind of trying to understand the appeal of the NRA, what one might do beyond insults, which is where a lot of, you know, more liberal people would go, to juxtapose the fearful call of the man in the who's just had his window pierced with gunfire and is begging 911, get us out of here, when are the police coming, with the NRA's message that year, which is stand and fight. And one sees this appeal when I would ask the NRA, and I would always invoke my Britishness, not least because in the eyes of some of them it tempered my blackness, but I would invoke my Britishness and I would say that I'm from Britain, I don't understand this gun thing, explain it to me. And to a person, pretty much, they would start this way: are you married? Yes. Do you have children? Yes. And then would come the dystopia. Imagine somebody breaks into your house and they want to rape your wife and they want to kill your children. What are you going to do? Are you going to wait for the police to come? Are you going to beam up with your fist when he's got... Are you going to protect your family? These appeals to masculinity, against government, homestead, vigilantism. Absent of the fact that actually people with guns in their house are more likely to be shot than people without them, that most people who are shot dead shoot themselves, but also that if you're not shooting yourself, the people who are most likely to shoot you are people you know. So what they should have said is, are you married? Well, watch out for your wife, because she is the person most likely to shoot you. There is this allegation, that, well, you know, why don't they talk about all of, you know, the black-on-black violence and the black-on-black crime? And the first thing to say about that is pretty much all American crime is pretty segregated, actually. White people kill white people, black people kill black people, and so on and so forth. And so black-on-black crime or black-on-black violence would better be just called crime or violence. That's how America works, or doesn't work. But then there is also this sense that nobody's doing anything, when actually they're doing lots of things with very little support and very little resources. But there's no concentration on guns. I would call this part of a nascent grassroots anti-gun movement, because they're dealing with the whole conditions that people are living in. And what you see after a while is, of course, I mean, America has what every other country has in terms of inequality, racism, poverty, segregation. Most countries have a version of that. The mental health issue is a tough one, because most other Western countries also have socialized health care, whereas in America the primary provider of mental health provision is actually prisons. But what they don't have, on top of that large pile of tinder, is the free and easy availability of weapons that can kill you. And that really does make a difference. And so these organizations are dealing with the whole thing. They're looking at schools and youth services, and of course, they, you know, gun violence comes into that. But here was one of the really amazing, to me, things that I learned talking to all of these families, was that when I asked the open-ended question, including to Mario, what is this about? You know, and again, I'd evoke my Britishness. Nobody mentions guns. Nobody. And I conclude that it's a bit like traffic. If your child got run over, you could no more imagine a world without traffic than many Americans can a world without guns. And so to talk about guns, well, you know, where's that conversation going? And because those guns aren't going anywhere. And if your child was run over and you decided, well, we need speed bumps on this road or we need a stop sign on this road, and you mobilize your community to do that, no one would claim it was unconstitutional. And therein lies the difference. And so they would fall back on these scripts. They would say, you know, babies having babies, families, mamas don't like their kids like they used to. These things that you can control. So you can talk about parenting, and there's no metric for it, so you can never say it's getting worse, or, you know, you could just, it's a safe place in a way to go. But then I started doing some research, and actually teenage pregnancy is going down. And that most of the people who were saying this, you know, and there's a lot of evocation of the ancient art of pugilism. In my day, people would scrap it out, you know, boy to boy, man to man. Someone would lose, someone would win, but everyone would be alive. Actually, the truth is that gun homicides were greater when most of these kids' parents were alive. But there's kind of nowhere really to put that, and an awful lot of these... When I ask the more leading question, what do you think of guns, then most people are like, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. There's too many. They're everywhere. But there is no connection between almost any of these people, with the exception of Jaden's mum, who I do see posting episodically now gun control-y things on Facebook. There's no connection between the gun control movement that we hear about, every town and all that kind of stuff, and these communities. They just don't, there's no engagement at all. And when you ask people, what do you think of the gun control debate? Well, it's like, I mean, what debate? They're not talking about us. I mean, or the extent to which they're talking about us, they're only talking about us as a problem. You know, that was unexpected for me. Tyler Dunn, age 11, is the one white boy who died that day. He was at a sleepover with his friend, who I'll call Brandon. His friend's a year older. Brandon's dad is a trucker, and the boys would often go with him on his trucking runs, take, you know, about 11 hours, often going down from rural Michigan all the way down to Ohio sometimes, and then back. Usually took about 12 hours. And the boys would come with them, they'd play computer games, and then they would help him unload or load. He'd give him $20, you know, it was a nice trip. And that was the plan on this day. November the 23rd, which is the day when all this takes place, it's just after the beginning of deer hunting season. But everybody in Marlette knew this. And so Tyler and Brandon and Brandon's dad had gone to try some deer hunting, I think, a day before. Tyler never caught anything in his life, but he liked the idea of it. And he's the youngest boy, three older sisters, incredibly spoiled, quite... His kind of upbringing was a mixture of... It was like Mark Twain with a cell phone, basically. So he would be trapping critters and doing all these things that, you know, playing dirt bikes and all that kind of stuff. And Minecraft, Call of Duty, you know, playing on his mum's cell phone. The dad says, okay, let's go trucking. And the boys say, we want to stay home, play Call of Duty and just hang out. And the dad says, oh, to hell with it. So he leaves them there. Some money for pizza, but he also leaves them there with several loaded guns in the house. Brandon is showing Tyler the gun. He gives it to him. He goes into his room to get his milkshake. He comes back, and Tyler's giving him the gun when Brandon says the trigger gets caught on his trouser pocket and shoots Tyler in the head. Couple of things emerge from this that I think are interesting. One is that there is technology actually available that would make guns an awful lot safer. There are, for example, there is a gun that is commercially available elsewhere in the world, but not really here, where there's a chip and pin, and if the gun is too far away from the thing on your wrist, then the gun won't go off. It needs to be close enough so that the owner is the only person who could shoot it. The NRA is against the sale of those. And New Jersey has a rule that within, I think, 2 years or 3 years of that gun being, that handgun being commercially available in America, they will insist that all handguns are made that way, something like that. And so the NRA is adamant that these should not be made commercially available in America. And so every time a shop stocks them, they get death threats, not from the NRA. The NRA don't do it, but the people who do it, I'd be amazed they didn't support the NRA. And these are gun shop owners. These are, you know, the NRA's base. They get death threats. They get one woman who was marketing this gun in California. They posted her home address online and a picture of her. Pretty much every time they do it, every time it looks like someone's going to do it, they stop because it's not worth the candle. The other thing is that there are safe storage laws available, which, while you can't legislate for that situation necessarily, you can provide a moral code for what one thinks of that situation, which is if your weapons aren't safely stored and somebody dies, you will pay the price. The NRA is against safe storage laws because they say that that would impinge on people's ability to defend themselves, and therefore, and Michigan doesn't have a safe storage law. So Brandon's dad gets a year in jail. 3 months of that is for corruption of a minor, which would be the same thing as if the kids found his porn stash or, you know, something like that. And 9 months is because he was a felon. And so he wasn't allowed to have guns. So if he hadn't been a felon, leaving two kids alone with loaded guns, one of them dying, he wouldn't have gone more than 3 months. Edwin Rajo, 16, Houston. Edwin lives in an area that is dominated by gangs, called this, a particular gang called the Southwest Cholo. But Edwin is a bit silly. He's a sweet kid. His mum came over on an 18-wheeler truck from Honduras, undocumented. Edwin's the eldest in his family. And in the words of one of his teachers, he wasn't a bad kid. He's a busy kid, she said. So he would get in the kind of trouble that isn't going to threaten anybody, but he will irritate lots of teachers. Now, the teachers in the kind of unit where Edwin would kind of end up most of the time, because he would be, you know, Edwin, get out of the class, all said, you know, he was a sweet kid. And they had other kids that they would talk about that they did not think were sweet. So, you know, I believe them. The school was a tough school, and there were plenty of rival gangs in the school. At one stage, when I'm talking to the head of the kind of behavior unit, she has to run off to either stop a fight or talk to the police. It's not entirely clear, but she's saying, excuse me, I think I've got to go. And her assistant says, you have to go faster than that. You have to go faster than that. No shoes, no shoes, no shoes. Come on, let's go. So, you know, hard things happening in this school, and teachers doing their best. Edwin's best friend is a girl that we'll call Camilla. She's an interesting one. She's same age. She's harder than Edwin. She is in the gang. I think the gang would think he's too much of a liability, really. And so he's not really in the gang, but he lives in a block. He's gang affiliated because the block is gang affiliated. But Camilla is in the gang, and her mum is in the gang, and her mum is a dealer. Camilla's a harder kind of, you know, nut to crack. She's also really smart, whip smart. And her teacher says, I thought she was going to be the one. She was going to be the one to break through that cycle. She wanted to be a pharmacist. She would call Edwin McLovin, which is after a character in Superbad, which is a kind of teen movie, who's just a kind of flaky In England, you call them a duffer. Just kind of not doing much, dude. Sometimes they would come home from school and she would be really kind of, you know, upset about bad grade or an assignment. And they'd just be like, oh, you know, what does it matter, really? What does it matter? And, you know, Camilla would want to just box him around the head. Anyway, her brother, a few months earlier, gets shot at by someone from a rival gang. And they decide that they should get a gun. Now, there was also the girlfriend of someone in a rival gang was staying in their apartment. She was always trying to hang out with them. They didn't like her. They used to, because she was partnered with a rival gang, Camilla used to kind of talk smack about her on the internet. Her boyfriend got upset, and so it was particularly against him that they feared that there would be a problem. So they get a gun. They don't know anything about guns. And Edwin's a ninny. So there's one night, that night, his younger siblings go off to see some puppies that are staying in a derelict building. He says he's going with them. Then he peels off to go and see Camilla. They used to smoke quite a lot of weed together. But they also have this kind of quite touching platonic relationship. It's really, it is quite moving when you see it play out. They're in the room and he says, let's get the gun out. Let's, you know, let's have some fun with this gun. And she gets the gun out and she takes the clip out, assuming it's empty, and points it straight at his chest. So it's touching his chest. And then pulls the trigger, not realizing that there's one in the chamber. As far as she can see, the gun is empty. And there's this moment where they both know that they can't turn it back. And Edwin says, you shot me. And she says, sorry, dude. And then Edwin's eyes go into the back of his head, and Edwin dies.
You're listening to Gary Young, Gun Down, Kids Getting Killed. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Edwin was the toughest one to find. And I was lucky. I found someone when I went to report on Kenneth Mills Tucker and the NRA convention. I found someone from Houston, and I said, well, one of my kids, I used to call it my kids, I said, one of my kids died in Houston, so I'm going to be going there. Can I have your details? And then I emailed her about Edwin, and she said, oh, I think I know someone who knows him. And it turned out that there had to be a whip round for the funeral, so they couldn't afford the funeral. And she had been on a Facebook chain of people kind of raising money for the funeral, and it was one of her friends. But her friend couldn't speak to me because it would violate all sorts of confidentiality rules. So she spoke to me off the record for quite a bit, but she couldn't point me in any directions. And then there was a, you know, there was a weird breakthrough where Edwin's, nobody knew where they were, and she assumed that Edwin was also undocumented, which he wasn't, but she said, you know, I don't think they want to be found. And just before I was going to go to Houston and just walk the pavements and just see what I could do, just as I did in San Jose unproductively, Edwin's mom contacted someone at the school who could talk to me, and there was this kind of breakthrough. And I went and I interviewed Edwin's mum, who, when I interviewed her, Marlene, her name, was 7 months pregnant, and whom I consequently discovered had a boy and called him Edwin. Samuel Brightman, 16, in Dallas, walking down the road with his friend Denzel. He's walking Denzel home. It's about 11 o'clock. And they spot a white Lincoln car, don't think much of it, keep walking. The lights are off on this Lincoln car. They can see a couple people in it, but they don't pay much mind. It's just a 6-minute walk to Denzel's granny's house. And Then the car starts rolling, then the lights go on, and then boom, and Samuel's shot. And he gets about 90 words in the Dallas Morning News, and that's it. And so I set out trying to find his mum. I find her through the funeral parlor, who connect me to her sister, who put me in touch with his mum. And Samuel is this sweet, quite fragile kid who is dyslexic, had trouble at school, kind of low self-confidence, was admitted to a psych ward for a little while, eager to please. Most of the women in his life would say, that's the kind of, you know, he was a sweet kid. He's the kind of son you want. He wouldn't ask, do you need help bringing the shopping in? He'd just run and help you bring the shopping in. And his protector is his sister, Whitney, who's younger than him, but by barely a year, and is tougher than him. And there's one occasion where some boys try to rough him up, and it's Whitney who comes out and sorts them out. There are two things about Samuel's story that I find striking, the broader story beyond him personally. The first is, how does a kid get removed from the planet and only get 90 words in a newspaper? And that's not particularly rare. None of these make big news. Now, Jaden's shooting, because of the nature of it, gets more, because it's more of a spectacle. Tyler gets a lot of local news because, or a fair amount of local news in Marlette. It's not like he gets any news in Detroit, but he gets some news in Marlette because not much happens in Marlette. And also, there's the ongoing thing of the trial and the other boy and so on. But most of these kids, 500, 600 words, sometimes a quote from the parents, sometimes not, but that's it. But none of that was Samuel. And you speak to the people who either write these stories or run these papers, and they say, you know, it's just not so surprising that a child would be shot in that area. Samuel lived in Pleasant Grove. And after a while, it feels like, well, there are areas in America where kids are not supposed to be shot. Malls, schools, movie theaters. And then there are areas where if they're shot, it doesn't challenge the way America understands itself, it just confirms it. That this is where kids die. Places like Pleasant Grove in Dallas. And no further examination is really necessary. And it made me think of that journalistic adage, dog bites man is not a story, man bites dog is a story. And this is understood to be a dog bites man story. But after a while, journalists have to ask themselves, I think, well, who controls these dogs? And why do the same people keep being bitten? And what can we do to mitigate the effect of these dog bites? Otherwise, it becomes this morally unacceptable, in my view, kind of white noise that America becomes comfortable with. It's the thing that comes on the news before the weather. Over there, not where I live, the person reading the news, and an assumption is not where you live, the person who's listening to the news, not where the people who write the newspapers live, over there, in some other place, a kid died. And they also almost become a different species. There was a woman underneath Samuel's story. One woman writes, you have to really ask about the parents here and what they're doing letting a child out at 11 o'clock at night. I always know where my kids are. And you see this way in which particularly African-American parents are blamed for the murder of their children. And then you take the trouble to find out, first of all, what they were doing that night. And that they were playing Uno, Samuel cheats. They were watching We're the Millers and literally drinking cocoa. And then Samuel decides that he will walk Denzel the 6 minutes home. It's not that Audrey, Samuel's mum, didn't know where he was. It's that she couldn't save him. If you're white and if you're wealthy, and certainly if you're white and wealthy, statistically these are unlikely to be your kids. All of these kids are working class, disproportionately black and Latino. But are they so different from your kids? Or kids you know? And are their parents so different from you, or parents that you know? I don't think so. So Samuel dies. Audrey, his mum, knows he's dead because she is following the ambulance to the hospital and the ambulance turns off the light. That's how she knows that her son is dead. Then comes the issue of how Audrey ends up in Pleasant Grove. Because they were in a suburb just a year before, doing quite well. But she worked for a Medicaid, a company that did home help. And the boss was being done for Medicaid fraud. And the lawyer said, you have to leave this job because otherwise you will be embroiled in this and there's nothing to do with you. So she leaves the job. And in leaving the job, she decides to get an operation that she's had to wait for a long time because this takes quite a lot of time to heal. And she thinks, well, this is a natural break. So she has the operation, she's healing, and then she is rear-ended in a car accident. Not her fault, but she ends up with a deranged knee, so she can't walk. She can't walk, she can't work. Her unemployment runs out, and she's evicted. She moves in with her sister, Deborah, but that's two adults and four teenage children in a two-bedroom house, and that's just not going to work for that long. And so the one place where Audrey can be self-sustaining with her kids is in an area with a shot credit and little money, is in an area where if your kid gets shot, nobody pays any attention. Next is Tishon Anderson. I knew, my wife is from Skokie, which is near Chicago, I knew that on the day, whatever day I chose, there was a good chance there would be a kid from Chicago. And I could also pretty much tell you where they would live within a couple of miles radius. Be on the south side, where the African Americans live, or on the west side, which is mostly Latino. Tishon Anderson was on the south side. He was standing in a stairwell. He was shot in the head. Tishon was a gang member. And there's no need to pass that for me. You can tell from his Facebook page, from his Twitter feed. But also, I spoke to his godmother. And the clique that he was part of is now, for the time being, named after Tishon. There's one posting on his Facebook page that has a span of $20 and then a pistol underneath, and it just says, a day's work. His godmother said to me that I've known him since he was born and I know he can be a good kid, but I'm not going to sugarcoat it. He was a bad kid too, and I know that he killed people. And so, weird as it sounds, I'm not quoting her word for word, but the next bit is accurate. I'm relieved that he's gone because I've been waiting for that call for a long time. And now I don't have to wait anymore. One of the chilling things that emerges from this story is another parent in the stairwell is interviewed by, on that night, is interviewed by a photographer. And she says, that's why I'm glad that my 14-year-old is in jail, because they can't kill him there. And you get a sense of the degree to which I interviewed Maya Angelou in 2002, and she said, well, African-Americans, I was asking her about 9/11. She said, African-Americans are living in a state of, have been living in a state of terror in this country for several hundred years. And so while this was a new thing and a big thing, the idea that you may be, that someone may be summarily, that there is summary violence that you might live in the situation you live in, did not shock us. Every single African-American parent that I spoke to, when I said, did you think this could happen? Did you imagine that this was possible? To a person, they said, well, yeah. Samuel's mum said, well, I didn't think it would be him. I thought it would be his brother. Gary Anderson's dad in Newark said, you're not doing your job as a black father in Newark if you don't think your child could be shot dead. Gary Anderson's wearing a red hoodie and he's got plaits and he goes out with his girlfriend to McDonald's, comes back around midnight. He's staying with his mum that night, and he's shot in the back of the head. It's assumed that the people who shot him were looking for somebody else who wore a red hoodie and had plaits. More than one person said that person that was being looked for went and gave his mum a hug and said, "I'm really sorry, that was supposed to be me." The area where Gary Anderson is shot is the poorest area of all of the areas that I look at. And Newark, much like Detroit and other areas, it looks like what happens when capitalism just doesn't need people anymore. A former industrial town where the jobs have gone to places where labor is cheaper and unions are weaker. And so it's all bricked up. There's one housing complex that's still working, and then there's another one that is entirely bricked up. The house next to the place where Gary Anderson grew up, he grew up with his dad, is derelict. There's actually birds flying in it and trees growing out of it. It's a former factory where Gary's granny worked, cosmetics factory. But there's no jobs in Newark. And so one of the jobs you might do if you're a young person is get into the drugs trade. There's money in that. It's not a lot of life in it. It's not a job for somebody who wants to make old bones, but there is money in it. Gary's dad was hoping that he would go and join his sister in North Carolina. Gary's dad actually wanted to move to North Carolina, but he was staying with his mother, Gary's grandmother, who'd lived in Newark all her life and didn't want to go. And finally, Justin Hinnan, 18, who was supposed to be leaving town the next day. This is in Goldsboro, North Carolina, small town. And so his dad had given him the green Cadillac that he was waiting until he graduated, but something went on with some cell phones I couldn't quite get to the bottom of, and Justin was suspended. Justin is a very, very smart kid, A grades. One woman who knew him very well was saying, she said, "I think he wanted to be street, but he was just too nerdy to be street. He was," she said, "he was not street material." And Justin, fairly typical 18-year-old, talking back to his dad. His room is in the back of the house, and he would often be getting girls in and out of his back window until his dad caught him. His dad caught him several times, and one could only assume that he didn't catch him every time. And he's hanging out with the wrong crowd. His dad is very eager for him to leave Goldsboro and start fresh. So even though he hasn't graduated, he gives them this green Cadillac. And Justin's driving the green Cadillac, not knowing that there's a marked man in the car. And a single shot, and I saw the Cadillac, it's in the dad's garage, a single shot, and you can see all the spider's web of the glass coming out. This misses its target and gets the driver, Justin. And the car rolls into a garden nearby. And that's it. That's it for Justin. I look at youth, because young people are actually chemically wired to take risks and to make mistakes and to be young, and to experiment. And Justin is hanging out with some kids who are gang-related, although he's not particularly sophisticated about it, so he hangs out with kids in different gangs, which one of his friends says is part of the problem. Like, you know, there are rules to how you do this, and he wasn't observing the rules. But I remember George W. Bush, when asked about cocaine use and alcohol when he was younger, and he was much older than Justin, saying, "When I was young and irresponsible, I was young and irresponsible," and being able to laugh it off. David Cameron, the former Tory Prime Minister in Britain, was part of the Bullingdon Club. Now, in the Bullingdon Club, you was the supper club at Oxford University for the very wealthy. They would wear tuxes and tails, well, bow ties and tails. They would go to an expensive restaurant. They would eat, they would drink, and then they would trash the restaurant and they would pay for it all in cash. Some of them would end up in jail, some of them wouldn't. Hijinks. Now, those are extreme versions of kind of how young people do, but we've seen what happened to both of those. They ended up leading very powerful countries and supporting awful wars and so on and so forth. But these kids don't get the chance to be young. That if you're black and you're in a low-income neighborhood, and I think if you're white and in a low-income neighborhood, actually, although race compounds this, the margins for these problems, for hanging out with the wrong crowd, for walking out late, for doing things that young people do, is death, or can be death. And that if that happens to you, people will say, well, I mean, look at him, you know. He was a thug, or he was this, or he was that. It doesn't take much for these deaths to be counted out of the possibility of compassion. Stanley had a prison record. Kenneth and a company he kept. Justin, Tashawn. If they're not damned by places where they live, so Samuel, not so surprising people would die in that area, then it doesn't take much for people to say, well, you know, this is, that's the life that they led. And to make up the rest, as that woman did when she said, well, you should know where your kids are. I mean, she's assuming some feral kind of beast in Samuel, as opposed to this sweet, fragile 16-year-old child. So I'm going to end with a very short reading. At 11:15 a.m. on Sunday, November the 24th, Cleveland police rushed to the 5500 block of Linton Avenue, where they found 16-year-old Darnell Jones shot in the neck. Paramedics took him to the Metro Health Medical Center, where he later died. There was no profile of who he was or who he wanted to be, no interviews with his parents. Beyond official records, there is no further evidence that he was ever on the planet. And so it goes on. Another 24 hours and the first of yet another slew of slain children whose stories will not be told and whose passing will provoke no outrage. I wanted to scream at Edwin and Brandon that guns are not toys. At Brandon's dad to either take the kids on his trucking run or stay home. At Stanley to quit hanging on the corner. At Justin to watch who he hangs out with. And at Tishon's mother to move. I wanted to scream at journalists and police to treat these deaths as though their lives mattered. But more than it's making me want to scream at anyone in particular, it's mostly made me just want to howl at the moon. A long, doleful, piercing cry for a wealthy country that could and should do better for its youth and children, for my children. But that appears to have settled, legislatively at least, on a pain threshold that is morally unacceptable. I want to bay towards the heavens because while kids keep dying, the political class refuses to not only do everything in its power, but anything at all to minimize the risks for the kids who will be shot dead today or tomorrow. Because it's though each death took place in helpless, hopeless isolation, a private, discreet tragedy complete unto itself. The broader context of race and poverty was clear to many. But when I told them of other families that had lost children that day, all seemed genuinely shocked that their grief overlapped in real time with that of others. It's as though they'd lost a loved one in a war without any clear purpose, end or enemy. A war they could do nothing about. A war they long knew existed, but hoped by luck, judgment, discipline, and foresight that they might be able to protect their kids from. A war that is generally acknowledged in the abstract, but rarely specifically addressed in the concrete. A war that took their children, but offered them no allies or community in their grief. A war they knew was taking place elsewhere, but experienced alone as though it were happening only to them. When in fact, it was happening to America every day. Thank you.
That was Gary Young, gunned down, kids getting killed. He spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. Gary Young is an award-winning columnist for The Guardian. He also writes the Beneath the Radar column for The Nation. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Angela Davis, Richard Wolff, Ralph Nader, Noam Chomsky, Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Gary Young, Gunned Down, Kids Getting Killed, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Ed Mays recorded the program. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.